to continue where we left off with regard to the events, the order of events, that is, first we do Kiddush, then we do Karpas. And between Karpas and the removal of the plate, the eating of the vegetable, the removing of the plate, we have Yachatz. Yachatz is the breaking of the matzah. Is because the story of the Exodus is supposed to be recited over in the presence of the matzah. And thus, we have to prepare the matzah. The matzah is supposed to be broken, because that is the way of a poor person, lechem oni, the bread of affliction. That, therefore, to demonstrate that, you break it into pieces. And you recite the Haggadah over a broken matzah. That has to be done at this point. It coincides with Karpas, because Karpas is to arouse the question of the child. Once you respond to the child, well, in our case, once you have the sipur, the telling of the story. The telling of the story begins with the manashtana. So when the manashtana is recited, it has to be recited in the presence of the matzah. The matzah that we're using is broken matzah, prusa. Thus, at this point in time, you have to prepare the matzah. So essentially, in the midst of the karpas, the matzah is being prepared. It's prepared in two ways. First of all, you break it. Now, in my opinion, that's the reason for saying halach ma'anya. This is the bread of affliction. Since the purpose of the matzah is to be related to the telling of the story, so one has to explain. That's part of the idea of preparing the matzah. One has to explain the relevance of the matzah, what the matzah has to do with the story, the broken matzah. This is the bread of affliction. So that's why we do yachatz, and the halach ma'anya, in conjunction with that, and afterwards, after you finish halach ma'anya, then you remove the plate to engender the question of the child. And then you recite the manashtana. That is, the child recites the manashtana, the four questions. According to the Rambam, the reader, the one who leads the Seder, has to recite the manashtana. After the recitation of the manashtana, then the Seder plate is brought back to the table, and you proceed with the Haggadah. With regard to the part of the Haggadah known as the four sons, it begins with Baruch HaMakom, blessed is God, blessed is He who gave Torah to His nation Israel. Then it says that with regard to four sons, the Torah spoke with regard to four sons, which seems to indicate that the objective, the mitzvah, as far as Torah is concerned, is of course to study the Torah and to transmit the Torah. They're one and the same. That's part of the mitzvah of studying. One studies for oneself, and then one has to transmit the Torah. That's part of the obligation of Talmud Torah. First and foremost, to one's own children. But of course, as the Rambam mentions, to every student, a Rebbe is obligated to teach any student. The only difference being that his own child takes precedence. The next issue would be, what connection does this have with the Seder? We already discussed that. That the mitzvah of Sipur includes a component of teaching one's children. Thus, it is obligatory in fulfilling the mitzvah to transmit the foundations of the Torah to the next generation based upon what took place in Egypt and the miracles that were done for the sake of establishing the Jewish nation and giving them the Torah. It would seem, therefore, that what we have over here is a bit of a primer. The Agada is including within itself a guide to the performance of the mitzvah, which is an educational phenomenon here. Thus, there's a lot of very interesting ideas. The most basic idea seems to be that in order to be an effective teacher, you have to be, to have an insight into the nature of the student. Not all students are alike. Not all students approach the subject matter in the same way. And different approaches have to be used for different levels. It's not only a matter of levels, it's different mindsets. Would appear that the various students that we're talking about fit into four categories. That itself is interesting. Why four? Let's go through the different sons, the four sons. The Chacham. So there's such a thing as a Ben Chacham, the wise son. What is it about the son that makes him wise? What's the distinguishing characteristic? So it says, what does he say? What are these testimonies and statutes and judgments that the Lord your God commanded you? That's very fascinating, because it doesn't go into any kind of a description. Classical technique, it gives you an illustration, and you're supposed to figure out from the illustration, from this question, you're supposed to figure out what is it that makes him a chacham, a wise son. It would seem, according to this definition, that the distinguishing feature is the intellectual curiosity. He's not being defined as a wise son according to his IQ. It's really, essentially, all these four categories have to do with how a person approaches the phenomenon in question, the relationship to the phenomenon. That is to say that there's things on display. The basic mitzvos that pertain to the evening are on display. And whoever is there is going to react in a certain way. So the Chacham is the one who has intellectual curiosity and formulates the proper question. The formulation of the question is the most significant aspect in the pursuit of knowledge, how to ask the proper question. So that's essentially the hallmark of the Chacham, that he recognizes that there's wisdom, that there's knowledge. He's keen to gain new understanding, and to do so, he approaches it without intellectual laziness, but he makes the observations. The question doesn't come into play until he's made all the observations that he's capable of making on his own. There is a bit of a difficulty, though, because it would seem that the one who wrote the composer of the Agada derived this statement of the Chacham from a verse in the Torah. This particular verse, which is taken to refer to the wise son, comes from Deuteronomy, that's the Varm, chapter 6, verse 20. And it's in that context there, it's not speaking about Pesach. It just says in general, when your son asks you tomorrow, mochar, meaning in the future, when you're settled in the land, what are these testimonies, statutes, and judgments that the Lord your God has given you, has commanded you? And you shall say to your son that we were slaves to Paro in Egypt, and God took us out with a mighty hand. And God placed signs and wonders, mighty wonders, and evil ones, plagues, the miracles in Egypt, and he took us out of there and brought us to this land, and he commanded us to do these statutes, that we should fear him for our own good all the days, so that we may live as this day. Suffice it to say that the answer that's given to the child who asked this question is not cited by the Baal Haggadah. If this is the question of the wise son, and this is the appropriate one, so then why don't you cite the answer? And the answer seems to be very appropriate too. It's explaining the origin, the foundation. The foundation is what took place in Egypt. And what God did for our sake and differentiated us and brought us out and gave us these mitzvot, these commandments. Instead it says that you should instruct him in the laws of the Pesach. That is, that one is not permitted to have any type of dessert after the Pesach, that once you eat the Pesach, you can't eat anything after that. However, we can ask, why doesn't the Haggadah give him the answer that the Chumash recommends? Which seems to have to do with the theme of the night. Perhaps more difficult is the case of the Rasha. We find something strange here. What does the Rasha say? What does the wicked son say? What is this service to you? What is the meaning of this service to you? Now, this is taken to be a statement of wickedness. The source of this quote, this question, is in Exodus, Shemos, chapter 12, verse 26. In verse 25, it's telling us, if describing the service pertaining to the Passover sacrifice, that it'll be when you come to the land that the Lord your God gives you, then you will perform the service. And it will be when your children, your sons, will say to you, what is the service to you? And it tells you what the answer is. There's no, it's predicting, it's telling you that it would seem part of the purpose. I think it should be pointed out. It doesn't say this by every mitzvah. When you do this mitzvah, and when your child asks. It doesn't say that. We're supposed to study each mitzvah and try and figure out the reason for the mitzvah. And when we perform it, we should have in mind what the ideas are. And when we teach it to our children, we should teach to them the halachos, the laws that pertain to it, how to perform it, and the objective of the mitzvah. The mitzvah of Pesach would seem that one purpose of the mitzvah is to evoke a question, to arouse the curiosity. So that's what it's telling you, that the child will ask, and you'll answer. And you'll say that it is a Passover sacrifice because God skipped over the Jewish houses in Egypt. When he smote Egypt, and our houses did he save. And it says, that when the people heard this, they bowed. Rashi explains the significance. That they bowed because of the news, the information about the redemption, that they'd be redeemed, and that they'd come to the land. Upsuras abanim. Shilam, and the news that they would have children. So they were happy about that, that this would be perpetuated, and the children, they would pass it on, the children would ask them. So there's no indication from any of this that we're talking about a wicked son. Let's see how the Haggadah works it out. The Haggadah says, wherein lies the problem? The word lachem. Lachem v'lo lo. That he chooses that word, what is the service to you? Which means that he excludes himself. And because he has excluded himself from the group, he's kofir, v'ikar. This is very, very serious. He's in denial of a fundamental principle. Then it says, and you should blunt his teeth. And say to him, Bavurzeh, Asar Hashem Li, B'tzeisi Mitzrayim. Quote him that verse. Because of this, did God do for me when I left Egypt? The answer that's given to the Rasha, if you go to the Torah, it's found in Shemos, Exodus chapter 13, verse 8. And you shall tell it to your son on that day, saying, Bavurzeh, because of this, did God do unto me when I left Egypt? Now in the Haggadah, that's a reference to the child that doesn't ask. Because it just says, you shall tell your son. It doesn't assign a question to him. So now you have something which is very funny. You're taking the Rasha, the pasuk that's attributed to the Rasha, to the wicked son. When you read it in the Torah, there's no indication that there's anything wicked about it. To the contrary, it seems to be a positive thing that the children are going to ask. And the answer that's given is instructive. There's nothing in the answer that's sarcastic. Yet the Haggadah has managed to take this verse and somehow or other give it an implication of wickedness. Then the answer to him is the answer that's given to the child that does not ask. Interestingly enough, that answer is found twice in the section of the four sons, because if you go to the Ani Yodei L'Shol, the one who does not ask, it says, you initiate. As it says, V'gat l'mincha b'yom hulema. Bavur zeh asar Hashem li v'seis mitzrayim. You shall tell your child on that day, because of this, did God do. But here it's without any of those deductions and implications. Which is very, very funny. On the one hand, in the one case, it's being used with these implications, these deductions. In another case, it's not. The hardest one to understand, though, is the wicked son. Wherein lies his wickedness? The instruction that's given is to blunt his teeth. Now, if you take a look at the wording, it says, you shall say to him because of this. You cite that verse. And you sort of play on words. Because of this God did for me when he took me out of Egypt. Me and not him. Which means that he's excluded. Had he not been there, had he been there, he would not have been redeemed. There's a bit of a difficulty here because it's not addressing him in the second person. It's addressing him in the third person. If this is what you're supposed to tell to him, then it should be, you shall say to him, me and not you, not me and not him. Had you been there, you would not have been redeemed. It should have been in the second person, and it should have said, li, to me, velo lecha, and not to you. Ilu hayisa sham, had you been there, you wouldn't have been redeemed. Suddenly, you're talking about him in the third person as though he's not around. What, does he stop talking to him now because he's a bad son? Who are you talking to? Indeed, if you check the Haggadah, called the Siach HaGrid, he mentions that the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, did learn that there is no answer that's given to the wicked son, but rather you're talking to the other children who are at the Seder, but not to him. Which I find a bit difficult. As again, I'm just saying in the framework of a question, I'm not one to argue with the Vilna Gaon. There's other interpretations besides this. I'm just saying I find that particular approach difficult. Because what's the point? Why mention it? Why bring it up? And it does say that you're supposed to blunt his teeth, which indicates you're supposed to address him. If you're not supposed to address him and you're supposed to ignore him, he shouldn't be at the Seder. And once he expresses himself in this way, ask him to leave. What's the point? What's the point of teaching us his question? And then ignoring him completely and talking to the other children and referring to him in the third person. That seems to be difficult to me. If we learn like the Gra, that may explain why he's being referred to in the third person. That's why, because you're not speaking to him, but it doesn't explain why aren't you speaking to him. Before we proceed any further, let's try and understand what exactly is the definition of the Rasha here, the wicked son. What makes it wicked? Rasha over here, wicked person over here, is not what the world considers to be wicked. They use the term evil. When the world uses the term, like America today in the war against Saddam Hussein, he's evil, he's wicked, it has to do with the amount of pain he inflicts on others, which clearly is wickedness. But there again, that's a symptom. It never gets to the underlying root. There's other forms of evil, other forms of wickedness that may not have the desire to inflict the physical harm. People who are indoctrinating others in false ideas, which have the effect of destroying their souls, and they could be doing it with great love and best of intentions. They're engaged in something which is evil. The world doesn't look at it that way. That false ideas are the ultimate evil. Denial of truth is the ultimate evil. It's worse than the type of evil that the world relates to, the inflicting of torture on others. It's worse in a philosophical sense. The reason being, if you put aside your emotions, of course, emotionally, it's hard to take. Because emotionally, we only recognize the good as being the physical, the emotional, and the bad as being pain and suffering. That is true, but that's not the ultimate. The ultimate is to deflect a human being from the real purpose, the real good, which is the truth, knowledge. That's what he was created for. And that's his ultimate destiny. That's his ultimate objective and good. To distort that, to destroy the mind, is a worse crime than to destroy the body. Which crime is worse? To take an individual who has obtained, through hard work, a significant amount of knowledge and truth and understanding, has correct ideas, is living a fulfilled life. And there are two choices. One is to kill him. The other is to destroy his mind so that he loses all of his knowledge, and in its place, he will have a completely distorted picture of reality. Falsehood. I'm just saying theoretically, assuming you could do both. I'm not saying how you would do that. This is just an example for argument's sake. Which crime would be worse? Well, it all depends what's the most important thing. If physical existence is the most important thing, so killing him would be the worst thing. Judaism would maintain that there is a soul, and the good of the soul is to have truth, correct ideas, and the corruption of the soul is the ultimate evil. If you want to put it in the perspective of the ultimate level of existence, you could argue this way, that true, if you kill him, it's a big loss, but he only loses this existence. But the soul will partake of eternal existence. If you destroy the soul, so then he has no existence left. He has nothing. Doesn't have this existence, because this existence is meaningless with false ideas, and he loses the ultimate existence. That's why the worst criminal, the one who's treated most severely in the system, is the Mesis, the seducer. And a Jew tries to persuade another Jew to worship idols. He has shown no mercy whatsoever. Even those forms of mercy that are displayed towards the accused in capital offenses. Even though he's tried and he's liable to the death penalty, there are many factors built in whose objective is to save him. They should save him. However, with regard to the emesis, the seducer, to the contrary, it's set up in such a way to make it more difficult to acquit. The objective is to destroy, not to show mercy to this individual. He's not deserving of mercy. Thus, the Rasha, the wicked person over here, his wickedness is with regard to his relationship to the phenomena, his relationship to the world of truth. And he's interested. It seems to me that he's at the Seder. We're talking about a person who's at the Seder. He's displaying interest. He's asking a seemingly harmless question. He's not going to sleep and saying, this is all boring, I'm not interested in this. So he wants to know, why are you doing it? What benefit do you get out of it? What meaning does it have for you? It could be someone who is a traditional Jew, who likes Judaism, who thinks it has a lot of meaning, and benefit and purpose and value. However, there's one thing he does not accept, and that is that there is an objective reality, that it's true, that it's absolute. It's lachem, it's to you, it's subjective. Everybody's got their own truth. That's a very popular philosophy today. How do you know that your ideas are correct? He feels differently. So there's many, many truths. That's the philosophy. That's the current philosophy in the world. Unfortunately, it's making its way into Judaism as well. And if that's the case, so there we have a whole new idea. Respecting differences. Pluralism. Pluralism is the philosophy of the day. Since we have no way of knowing which is true, we should respect everything, and perhaps we can gain from everything. From this one, he has it his way. There's many, many, that idea that there's many truths. But there's no objective truth. That is what defines him as being a Russia, because he's in line with the world of truth, with the world of reality. That's the implication. Because he's removed himself. He's saying, this is for you, and it's very nice. I like your religion. Keeps the family together. It instills values. People need to believe in something. Oh, it doesn't matter what the content is. They need to believe in something, and just by virtue of the fact that they believe in something, it's nice. And it's nostalgic, and it's traditional. Traditional, our parents did it this way. Gives us a sense of continuity. These types of arguments. These are people that feel very strongly. And they like to come to the Seder. But they do so only because it's lachem. It's for you. That, I maintain, is what the Haggadah is referring to. And that's why I say that could be that the overwhelming majority of people, of all Jews that go to Seder, which would include not necessarily Orthodox, but all Jews, would fit into this category. And they're not bad people, even though they're called wicked.
I'm going to the same exact spot.
With regard to the point we've been making, that the answer to the Russia is based upon the fact that we're asserting that Judaism is an objective reality, and that his wickedness consists in the fact that he's denying that there is such a thing as an objective truth. It's very interesting to note what the Mishnah Berurah says with regard to Shabbos HaGadol, the great Shabbos, which is observed immediately the Shabbos prior to Pesach. And the Shulchan Aruch Tuf Lamed says, Shabbos Shlofnei HaPesach, the Shabbos before Pesach, Koren Oso Shabbos HaGadol, is called the great Shabbos, Mibnei HaNis Shenas Abo, because of the miracle that took place then. Question is, what is the miracle? The Mishnah Berurah explains, Nehanis, Shabashana Shayotum Mitzrayim, on the year they left Egypt, Haya Asar ben Nisan, Biyom Shabbos. The 10th of Nisan came out on the Shabbos. The 10th of Nisan, they were commanded to set aside the sheep for the Pesach sacrifice, which was to be brought on the 14th. This was unique to Pesach Mitzrayim. That is to say, that in future generations, of course, they had to bring the Pesach, but there was no specific command to set aside the animal 4 days before. Rashi takes that up. Why it was that in Egypt, they had to set aside the animal 4 days before, something which was not required in all the subsequent years. The Mishnah Berurah continued, V'loku kalechet me'Yisrael se'el l'pischo. Every Israelite took a sheep for his Pesach sacrifice. V'kishro b'kare hamita, and tied it to the legs of the bed. Then he says, V'amitzrim ra'ozeh, and the Egyptians saw this. V'sha'alum, and they asked them, L'mozeh Lachem. What is this? Lachem, to you. Which is the same as the Russia. Mohavodazos Lachem, the same word. What is this service to you? Ve'yishivo, and they went into them, l'shochto l'shem Pesach, to slaughter it for the sake of the Pesach. The mitzvahs are Hashem aleinu, because of God's command to us. V'hayu shinehem keos. This is the exact same expression. And their teeth were blunted. Al sheshochtim es Elohehem, because they were slaughtering their god. The Egyptians worshipped the sheep. And they couldn't say anything. They couldn't respond to them. And because in that year, the 10th of the month was on Shabbos, Al Kain Kavu Likros Shabbos Shalaflam Pesach Li Olam Shabbos Agadol. So thus, the Shabbos, to remember this, in commemoration of this, the Shabbos, which always comes out before Pesach, whether it's the 10th or not the 10th, is always referred to as Shabbos Agadol. This confirms a number of things. We quoted the Pasuk, which says that when your child asks you, what is this worship unto you? That's a reference, that question in the Torah is stated with regard to the Korban Pesach, to the Passover sacrifice. Which is to say that it's not two separate things, that you have the mitzvah and you do the mitzvah. And then of course, if somebody asks you, so you're supposed to be able to explain to him the idea behind the mitzvah. That's true with regard to all the mitzvahs. But here it seems that it's embedded in the very nature of the mitzvah. The very nature of the mitzvah is designed to evoke questions. It's part of the purpose. And you see this element in Mitzrayim. I don't think it was just an accidental phenomenon, that they were commanded and they did it, and just accidental that the Egyptians happened to notice. It seems that was part of the intention, that they should do this action, knowing full well that what they were doing could be extremely dangerous. Obviously, it's not going to be very, very popular. It's very offensive. It's always offensive to make light of other people's religions or religious practices. And in general, people try to avoid that. Obviously, you have to use your judgment. In America, you have to be careful. But in this situation, they weren't just being offensive. They were doing something which would be considered a desecration, to take their holiest object, something which they worshipped, and to utilize that very object in the service, in their own religious service. So, of course, you have to come to the conclusion, there's no doubt that the Egyptians are going to notice this kind of thing, and the Egyptians are going to question. What's interesting to note is that they asked the question. They weren't upset until they heard the answer. The mere fact that the Jews were setting aside a sheep, in and of itself, it seems, didn't necessarily bother them. They asked the question. When they heard the answer, that blunted their teeth. It seems to me that by setting aside the sheep and not actually doing anything to it other than tying it up, that aroused the curiosity of the Egyptians. Not necessarily in a negative way, because to the contrary, on the surface it might seem to support them, that there's something very significant about the sheep. You see, even the Jews are going to use it. And indeed, the Jews, when they were in Egypt, had been affected by the religion, as Rashi points out, that to a large extent they were steeped in idolatry. That was a significant element, purpose of the Korban Pesach. Before we go any further, when I say that the mere fact that they tied up the sheep in and of itself doesn't necessarily imply a refutation of their system or a degradation even, I think we have to understand a little bit better when we say that they worshipped the sheep. On the surface, that sounds so absurd and so ridiculous that no sane person can even relate to it. anybody knows that this sheep is something which was just born. It's part of the system of the natural order. And is it possible that a human being could be so stupid that the person would believe that this animal, which is on a lower level than them, doesn't have the same intelligence, speech, or anything? And it's clearly something which came into existence, which was born and then dies, that this is some kind of a deity? I don't think that that's what they believed. Without going into all the particularities, they believed that the world was under the control of quote-unquote higher forces, powers. A superstitious type of phenomenon, the realm of the supernatural, without spelling it out, that there's different forces out there. That's what they believed. In the unseen, that's why they had magicians, and the objective was to influence these different forces. That's what they believed in. However, they believed that there were certain entities, certain objects in the physical world, which represented or were connected in one way or another to these higher forces. And that by worshipping these images, whether it be of animals or other things, so that would get them in good favor with these gods, with a small g, with these sub-deities and the like. That's a rough general explanation of their state of mind. So they all agreed that what's happening on this earth in terms of our physical existence is not the end of the story. They weren't total naturalists to say this is it, nothing more. There's a natural order. We can't account for it. There's nothing beyond it. And we deal with the natural order. That would be a basically atheistic position which was founded upon a rational approach to the physical world. I'm not saying a rational approach to reality, because we maintain that it's not rational. Because you have to give an accounting of where this order comes from. So it's irrational on that, in that sense, because it's denying a significant element. However, what I'm trying to say is that perhaps today a scientifically trained individual who does not want to acknowledge a higher being, who does not want to acknowledge the Creator, might take the approach that this is it. The only thing that exists is this world, this universe, and it operates according to natural order. So that such a person, it would seem anyways, wouldn't be superstitious, wouldn't be concerned about the unseen, because he would deny the unseen. There's no unseen, there's just the nature. The Egyptians were not on that level. The Egyptians maintained that there was something higher, which was responsible, which did intervene. However, the determination of what that whole realm was not made by true study, like Avraham Avinu. True study was made rather along the pathway of their own superstitious emotions. The emotionalism kicked in. It was idolatrous, it was primitive in that sense. It was involved in the whole world of projecting different forces. There are different forces out there, many different forces out there, contending with each other. And the physical object that they utilized was essentially symbolic. Not that they believed that this particular sheep itself ruled the world. They didn't have this concept of a supreme being, a supreme ruler. Or perhaps you might say that they did. But they believed that this being was completely remote from the world, and that what took place in terms of man was affected by these sub-deities. The Egyptians, perhaps, believed that the Jews were going to use their deity, sub-deity, whatever it was something which symbolized their deity to them. In noticing that they set aside the sheep, that does not necessarily imply something hostile. Because they could have thought, oh, they've been influenced by us. So they asked them, what is this to you? What meaning does it have to you? Assuming that the Jews also were on that level of subjectivism, which perhaps might not have been such a bad thing, if that's the case. The answer was that we're doing this, we're sacrificing this object as a service to God who commanded it, which indicates that we've nothing in common with you. And to the contrary, part of the objective is to refute your entire contention that there's any sanctity in this object. There is no sanctity in any object, and there is nothing out there except the Supreme Being, the Creator of heaven and earth. And to the contrary, that's the perfection, to give up these nonsensical ideas, to take this object which people have falsely, to give up all of our false notions, religious notions, idolatrous notions, to get rid of them in a recognition that the only being that one should relate to in terms of worship is the Creator. And we should operate according to His commands. When they heard that, they couldn't come back with anything. They were broken down. You do see from this that the Torah maintains that we have to break down the false notion, false religions, and especially the idea of subjectivism. That there's not one truth, there's no objective truth, there's many truths. That's a denial of the truth. There's no such thing as many truths. If a person asserts many truths, he's denying truth itself. As we've explained it, truth means that which conforms to reality. And if you're going to say many truths, you're going to say many realities, in which case you have fallen into philosophical schizophrenia. Thus, again, anyone who maintains that there is any truth in any religion outside of Judaism, that is to say that Judaism perhaps has some truth, but Judaism doesn't have the only truth or the complete truth, and that there are other religions which have essential truths that would somehow or other complement or add to Judaism, that is absolute kfira. That's absolute denial. Judaism, meaning to say, the true Torah, which consists of the written law in accordance with the interpretation that was given to Moshe at Sinai, what we refer to as the oral law, is God's revelation to mankind. For the Jews, of course, to keep the 613 mitzvos, for the Gentiles to keep the seven Noahide laws. But aside from that, the basic truths, the philosophical truths, everything the Torah teaches about God, how we're to understand the concept of God, the correct idea of God, the nullification of idolatry, the nullification of projecting any type of powers onto physical objects, all of the philosophical perfections that a person ought to strive for, this is God's revelation to all mankind. The Torah has more than just mitzvos and laws. It has a profile of correct philosophical approach to reality and the proper behavior for human beings, the purpose of Adam, of mankind, and how to achieve their philosophical perfection, how to achieve their objectives. That's true for all mankind. Insofar as that is concerned, all of mankind is equal, because they're all created B'Tselem Elohim, the image of God, so to speak, the soul. That's the essence of man. So there's only one definition of Adam. And if there's only one definition of Adam, there's only one concept of the purpose of Adam, of man, and there's only one idea as to what a person ought to do in order to achieve it. That's true. That prescription's for everyone. When we speak about the perfected individual, that applies to whether the person is Jewish or whether the person is not Jewish. Indeed, Gentiles who accept the seven Noahide laws and live a correct life according to the Torah are righteous people and have a share in the world to come.